Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Merrick Rysavchinsky podcast. It's me solo today. Merrick is apparently, according to producer Matt, doing a number of promotional things ahead of the big trade deadline on Monday, which should be fun. I don't believe myself and my diarrhea pants are appearing on Sportsnet this year. I don't believe Gord Stellick is either. They unfortunately have an influx of what you would call talent. Thanks to their big old merger with CBC. So there's a finite number of segments in the day, and I don't think that we necessarily are going to be making the cut. But who knows? Maybe it'll be a last-minute run-in by your boy on the trade deadline coverage. If not, plenty of stuff in Puck Daddy that day. The usual Chatterbox hourly blogs. And also, I think we're doing a post-deadline video show. If I'm not up there doing the Sportsnet thing. Just got back from Cali last night in time for the Oscars. I will save the Oscars talk for the end of the show so as not to upset the people who hate when I get all pop culture-y. Rob Zepp of the Philadelphia Flyers is going to join us early. Jonathan Willis of Cult of Hockey blog and the Edmonton Journal will join us later to talk about the other big news of the weekend, which was the adoption of analytics and fantasy stats by NHL.com, as well as a number of other changes. That was thanks to everybody who had kind words about the story that we wrote about that whole shebang on Friday night. We had the chance to kind of get ahead of the curve on it and find out some really interesting stuff about the future of where it's all going. I'm telling you, man, the one thing that blew me away in a big, big way was the as I talked to Merrick about it on Friday or Saturday, whatever the hell it was the ability to go inside of a game in a 3D digital environment if the player tracking gets to that point and follow the puck around and follow the players around and literally break down every single play like you're there. It's crazy. We'll talk about that later because we've got a finite number of time with this cat. Joining us now on the line, Philadelphia Flyers goalie, a man that Ed Snyder honored by calling the number three goalie yesterday, Rob Zepp of the Flyers, joined us now on the podcast. Hey, Rob, it's Greg. How you doing, man?
Good, thanks. How are you guys?
Doing well. Congratulations on a big, big weekend, back-to-back wins over Nashville and the Caps. What did Craig Berube say to you about playing these two games and grabbing the mantle for a little bit?
Not too much. I got called up last Monday, I believe it was, and I know from my previous experience that whenever I'm up, I just need to be ready to go. And you know, they let me know obviously on Friday that I was going to be playing on Saturday, and you know, I was you know, prepared in my mind. Those other two recalls that I had earlier on in the year helped prepare me for that, and I was just ready to go.
Yeah, and we've talked to a number of guys who kind of straddle the line between the AHL and the NHL all the time. And, you know, one of the things they always talk about is the speed of the game maybe being a shade different between the two levels. Are there any adjustments you have to make as a goalie going from one league to another league as frequently as you have this season?
Yeah, certainly. The speed is quicker. The plays happen quicker. Pucks come to the net from all angles and in different situations that you wouldn't otherwise see. And, you know, obviously there's players, some, you know, very special players in this league that can do things that other people, you know, can't throughout the world. So, like I mentioned earlier, my previous two call-ups to the Flyers certainly helped prepare me for this as well, as, you know, I've gotten my feet a little bit more wet each time.
Now, you know, this, I've seen you mention that this is sort of a dream come true for you and that whole thing, as far as getting the shot in the NHL after bouncing around as much as you have. But, like, you're not just, like, making it happen. Like, you've become kind of a cult hero for Flyers fans. How does that feel to know that, you know, when your name is called, when you get the gate, when they see 72 between the pipes, Flyers fans kind of ears perk up about it?
Well, as much as I appreciate that. I try not to get too caught up in that kind of thing. It's, you know, I'm out here to do my job, and I'm just trying to prepare each day, stop and box. And, you know, as flattering as all that stuff is, I try not to get too caught up in it because, that, you know, at the end of the day, it's my job to stop pucks, and, you know, that's what I'm here to do. And if I do that, all that other stuff will take care of itself.
And when you say it's a dream, I mean, is it just the fact that at some point in your life in the last 5, 6 years, whatever it's been, you said to yourself the NHL thing might not happen?
There's always a possibility. You know, there's always that thinking going through your head that it might not happen, because obviously as the years go by and I get older and the more I play and it hasn't happened yet, that I guess is, kind of becomes more of the reality. But I always believed that I could do it, and I had a lot of people surrounding me that also believed that and helped me to, push towards that. And some circumstances fell into place, and this opportunity arose. And, I knew that if I didn't take a chance at it, that it certainly probably would never happen. So I wanted to at least give myself that opportunity to at least put myself in the best position that it could happen.
Yeah, and you played your ass off in the preseason. You put yourself in that conversation. I mean, I got to imagine that, we've all had that moment in life where we're given that opportunity, and some of us rise to it, and some of us, can't quite grab the brass ring. You got to come away with this at least knowing that you were given the shot and you hit the target,
Yeah, certainly. The preseason went really well, and as did training camp. My goal going into camp in preseason was just to try to go in there and make as good of an impression as possible and show them that I could play at this level. And I had really positive feedback, from the coaches and goalie coach and from Hexie as well. And he kind of left me with, if we ever get in the situation where we need to bring somebody else in, for whatever reason, for injury or whatever, that we feel really confident bringing you in. And that, for me, that was kind of mission accomplished in training camp, and I think that kind of helped set the stage for that first game that I played there in Winnipeg.
Yeah, and doing what you've done so far for them in the time that you played for them, I mean, is there a sense you're kind of carrying the battle flag for some of the goalies that are still playing overseas that came from North America that may have fallen through the cracks? I mean, there's a lot of guys over there that probably come back and do the same thing that you're doing here but just don't get the shot for whatever reason.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things that have to line up. The stars kind of have to align, and you have to take advantage of your opportunity. And, when I was over there playing, I looked up to guys, and I guess the best example would be Timmy Thomas, and he came over in his 30s, and we all know what he accomplished, and that was motivation for me big time, and he was an inspiration for me watching his story unfold. And he also, I think, opened the minds of managers and teams throughout the league to be more open to a guy who's more experienced and has played overseas and look at them as a viable option in the organization.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw Giroux's quote the other day, but he put you over big time and put over the German league big time. He's like, guy wins 5 Deutsche League titles. He knows how to win. Just because it was Germany doesn't mean it's not still leading the team to a championship.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the level of play is different from league to league, but winning is winning. And, the German league's an excellent hockey league, and he could attest to that. Him and Danny Briere were with us during the lockout, and it's a bit of an underrated league, in my opinion, and I spent a lot of time there, and it really helped to develop and form my game during my time there. And I obviously appreciate that quote from him, and anytime a player that stature says something like that, it certainly means a lot.
Finally, sir, and thanks for the brief time before you hop a flight. Everybody's looking at these standings now. They're seeing the Flyers 4 points out. They're right back in the thick of things. Are they going to be able to pull this thing off?
Yeah, sure. Why not? We have a great group of guys here, and for myself, coming up and down throughout the year, the guys have been great, really receptive to me, and it just shows that they have a real tight bond here. And we all believe in what we can do here, and there's a lot of talent and a lot of desire on this team. And when those things are clicking, we're definitely a tough team to beat. So there's a lot of hockey left to be played, but over the past few weeks, the guys have put themselves in a great position.
Nice. Awesome stuff, man. Hey, thanks for the time. Continued success and good kick in the ass for that team over the weekend, sir. Have a safe flight.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
The lovely and talented Rob Zepp, journeyman hero for the Philadelphia Flyers. We asked you question of the day today to give us your favorite cup of coffee goalies, the Rob Zepps for your team, the guys who came up, made an impact, positive or negative, and then maybe didn't really stick around. Tom Kenish, seconding Dan LaCosta of the Columbus Blue Jackets, went to the San Jose game thinking it would be ugly, and of course it was not. Brian Palmer, Jean-Sebastien Aubin, went 9-0-2 with a 2.22 goals against and a 9.24 save percentage down the stretch for the 05-06 Leafs, leading them to ninth place. Gabe Walker, here's a good one. U.S. Olympic hero Ray LeBlanc played one game for the Blackhawks and gave up one goal in the win. I remember that. Remember LeBlanc. Yukon Cornelius with an interesting one. I'd say Michael Layton counts for the Flyers. 32 games, 918 save percentage, took us to the Cup, never to be seen again, only two games after that run. I think that qualifies. He might be the ultimate example, actually. He might be the ultimate example of that. Chris Peters also says LeBlanc, one career start. Steve Shields, Wade Flaherty is a good one as well. Obviously, there have been a few people rallying to the cause of Wade Dublowitz, the Islanders great. Peter Ng gets a shout-out from M. I remember watching him on Hockey Night in Canada as a kid here in Buffalo since we could pick up that station. Yeah, there's a good number of them. I like this. It's a good topic so far. Also a good topic, analytics. Joining us now, Jonathan Willis, one of the masters of fancy stats amongst hockey bloggers, writes for Cult of Hockey and elsewhere. Jay Will, how are you, sir?
Doing great, Greg. How are you?
Doing fine. Now, the big rollout happened over the weekend for the NHL, finally bringing fancy stats and analytics to NHL.com. On the one hand, the validating of these stats certainly does create a ceasefire in the ongoing war between those who believe these stats have validity, a.k.a. smarts, and those who don't, a.k.a. the Neanderthals. But unfortunately, the rollout has not been without some controversy as well. What are your likes and dislikes so far of the NHL.com adoption of analytics?
Well, I like that they're making an effort, so I guess kudos for that. The dislikes, I guess, the biggest one for me and probably for a few other people would be the cackling self-congratulation as they applaud themselves on doing something a hobbyist did a decade ago. Like, there's literally nothing there that Gabe Desjardins didn't have on Behind the Net in 2006. And you know, this is the NHL's best effort, their cutting-edge breakthrough, and there's nothing there. There's nothing there that's new.
Yeah, and there is a sense that like they're standing on the backs of the of what's already been done. I it's interesting the changing of the stat names from Corsi and Fenwick. There's an aspect of getting rid of the Patrick Division and Adams Division and renaming the Campbell Conference to that. But there's also an aspect of, well, if you really want these things to cross over, you do have to kind of make it more in layman's terms. But you're right. I mean, essentially, they've adopted all of the work that's been done for years by other sites, claimed it kind of for their own. And the question, I guess, is the NHL going to be the right steward for these things?
Well, and I don't really have an issue. And maybe it's just because I'm not a person who's been running one of these stats websites that, you know, the ideas were kind of borrowed from. And my name isn't on any of these fancy analytics. But that doesn't really bother me. What bothers me is that I don't think they do a very good job of it yet. Like if you click on the NHL's official stats site, maybe it'll change. This is just phase one after all. It's significantly less than what you can get if you go to, say, waronice.com. Like there isn't a matchup between the two. It's an inferior product at this point in time. And the other thing is the guys they have coming out and presenting it, like I think it's Chris Foster who is repping the NHL. He did an interview with a Kings blogger and said that, you know, well, he was asked what new stuff they were bringing. He said, well, you know, we're gonna give you drawn penalties, and I think zone starts are totally new. And it's just like you don't really understand how can you have your main communications person not understand what's actually been done in the field? It doesn't make any sense to me.
And you talk about the functionality thing. I mean, I'm obviously happy at least they're making some semblance of an effort. And from everything I've seen, there's a lot more to come down the road. But you're absolutely right. I mean, they released a site that doesn't have the basic search and filtering functionalities that War on Ice has for things like ice time and things like games played for a lot of these stats.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually sort of an ongoing problem with NHL.com. Because, I mean, if you wanted to look at, say, shooting percentage leaders, you type that into just the regular stats site, and you end up with a bunch of guys who played one game and scored one goal on one shot. Like, they
right.
don't have the kind of filters that just sort of come naturally with advanced stats sites.
Yeah, you're right. And the other what's interesting about it, the only stat where they actually filter out based on games played, I think, is faceoffs. They have that option for faceoff leaders versus anyone taking a draw, probably because at the end of the day, you know, 90% of forwards have taken a draw at some point, including some defensemen. So it's like, you got to do it for that stat, but they don't do it for anybody else. And it really does make it kind of maddening when, you know, even something as simple as like save percentage for goalies, like you see, you have to filter out the first 7 or 8 results that come back before you get to the guy who actually has played more than 30 games this season. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, maybe we shouldn't be surprised by this given how their site has been run, but like you mentioned face-offs. Is there a reason I can't see how a guy has done in terms of defensive zone face-offs on NHL.com? Like it is impossible to find this information. It's like pulling teeth.
From a big picture standpoint, and you've obviously been somebody on the front lines for a lot of this stuff over the years, vis-a-vis, you know, should we buy into fancy stats? Should we care about analytics? Are the nerds making hockey less fun and all that stuff? Do you kind of feel, I mean, do you personally, as someone who has been trumpeting this for a long time, do you feel vindicated at this point that now the NHL has given this validity? Or are you someone who feels like the other side of this argument is going to keep banging on the drum and trying to keep the fight going, even though it may now be a losing effort?
Well, I don't think we're ever going to see the argument go away. I mean, it hasn't really totally gone away in baseball yet, which is tremendous. And if you're a 40-year-old beat reporter and you've learned to do this a certain way and you're really not wild about the stats sites, I don't think having it on NHL.com is going to change that. As for vindication, maybe I'm the wrong guy to ask, but to me, the things that vindicate this is when you look at it and you say, you know what, this is kind of predictive. I can look at, you know, the Kings have this terrible record in one-goal games and they have a great Fenwick number, and I can go back to them and say, this is a much better team. And then when they win the cup, I go, you know what, that idea was a good idea. And if it bears itself out in the results, I don't need right. NHL.com to say, okay, guys, we think you've done good work. We're going to put it on the site. Gold sticker for you.
Now, obviously, one of the things that's sort of exciting about this innovation is not what's happening now, but what will come down the road a bit. And I wanted to pick your brain on some of the phases that have been released publicly insofar as this relationship between the NHL and SAP. First off, what are your thoughts about the ability to compare today's players with the players of yesteryear? I mean, from a trivia standpoint, it's going to be a blast to take, Gordie Howe's first 5 years in the league, compare him with Stamkos, compare him with Sid, whatever. But from a logical, statistical standpoint, is it just going to be trivia, or is there going to be value in trying to make these comparisons considering the context that's going to be lost?
Well, I think it's super interesting. Like I'm a hockey geek. I mean, you can't cover hockey for a living and not be a hockey geek, right? So you love this stuff. But from a usefulness standpoint, it's amazing what we don't know about the game. Like if we look just picking goalie save percentage, like if you go back to the 1960s, the 1940s, the 1920s, you don't know really anything about goalie save percentage compared to what it is right now. And because we don't have this 100-year history, just purely from a logic, usefulness, analytics standpoint, we can't say this is how the game has evolved, this is what has happened over the history of the game, and we can't take lessons from it. And I think what we know is significantly weaker because we don't have that information. And so I think it's tremendous, even taking all the fun out of it, because Lord knows we don't want to have fun with this, but just from a purely usefulness standpoint, I think there's going to be a lot of things that we learn from the information.
Right, exactly. And then you talk about the information. I mean, obviously we're going to get a huge glut of it from player tracking, which is a very exciting innovation. What would you like to see generated in real time from this technology if we actually get around to implementing it?
Honestly, that it's such a it's so difficult to describe because it's like a paradigm shift, right? Like you're stepping into a whole new world of information. What we have is useful. It's great. We can do interesting things with it, but we're barely scratching the surface. Like just as an example, if you have chips in all the jerseys, you can track where every player is on the ice in every second of the game relative to where the puck is every second of the game, and you can learn so much more that we don't even know right now. I think it's a sort of a brave new world, and I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I think the place that's really kind of failed us as far as analysis is goaltending, right? I mean, like, we've got a few stats that are good. A lot of us use even strength save percentage as a crutch, and I've heard counter arguments from goalies saying it's actually your save percentage on the PK that you should pay attention to versus even strength. So we don't really have a really sharp set of tools statistically when it comes to measuring goaltenders. So I imagine when we start getting to things like actual analysis on placement of shots, distance of shots, quality of chances, that kind of thing through player tracking, that'll exponentially help us understand goalies better.
Absolutely. And I think things like shot location, like there's a lot of people who tell you how unreliable the current data is. I think the current data is pretty good in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, not hit totals or whatever, but one of the weaknesses is that, you know, you have people manually tracking where these shots are coming from. You don't know the speed of the shot. What you don't know is incredible. So I think with an actual tracking system, we'll have so much more information, and we'll be able to tell you a lot more about goalies that we just can't tell you right now.
Right, and like you said, the player tracking to see where everybody on the ice is. I was talking about that right before you hopped on. The ability to now officially, inside of a 3D environment, point to a guy behind the camera and say he didn't back check, or point to a guy behind the camera and say his change was terrible coming off the bench and that's the reason why this happened, is going to be a very revolutionary thing. And I think at some point the discussion will be had between the PA and the NHL as far as how much of this we really want out there in specifically being able to demonize players for their lack of effort.
Well, and that's one perspective for sure. The other thing that when you think about it that way, it's really going to help demystify what coaches preach, right? Because that's sort of the final frontier in terms of analysis. Like there are some commentators who are really good at pointing out systems play and this is how the coach drew it up. But it's one of those things that as a hockey covering media, and I'm, you know, lumping the blogs and the MFM and everything together here, we don't really say, okay, well, you know, this coach is preaching a 2-1-2 and he has his guy coming in along the boards, whereas this guy has him coming in at the face-off dot. And there's lots of stuff we're missing. If we have player tracking data, we're really going to demystify that. We're going to be able to say, this is what coaches do. And maybe that's something the teams aren't going to want out there.
Right, exactly. And you talk about available information. I think one of the interesting things that's going to come down the pike for all of this stuff that we're going to see the league try to dabble in the next 2 years is how much is going to be available to us. How much of that player tracking data is going to be public? How much of it's going to be behind a paywall? How much of it's just going to be for the players and the teams? And depending on how much they release, what do we do with it? Because the other thing about this is, like, you know, they can claim ownership of the stats, they can claim ownership of the information, they can put into their terms of service that sites like War on Ice and before that Extra Skater can't scrape the box scores anymore. But there's always going to be smarter, better analysis of these stats off the official site than there will be on the official site. So I'm wondering what will actually be available to people either for free behind a paywall or that's not proprietary to the teams?
It's a fantastic question. And I mean, the NHL's track record is not encouraging. Like Gary Bettman this weekend, you know, he said that he didn't think fans were interested in a CapGeek type site officially, you know, provided by the NHL, even though they have all this information already set up internally, they're not sharing it. And even though it's proven, like CapGeek was a very successful site. I mean, everybody misses it. There's sites like NHL Numbers now that aren't quite as functional. But this is stuff that we know people are interested in. We know it'll draw traffic. We know the NHL has it already set up, and they won't share it. So how willing are they going to be to disclose information that they think is important if they don't feel they have to?
Why do you think they don't share it? I've heard I was the guy who asked Bettman that question because I was genuinely curious, and his answer was, as you said, kind of surprising, because I really think there is a market for it. He believes the media is the only one interested in this stuff, and I mean, we obviously are, but I think fans are too, especially when it comes to the search functionality that CapGeek had. But I mean, I can't quite figure it out, because the only thing I can figure is that it's the GMs that don't want everyone to be able to see inside the books and the mistakes they make and all that stuff. That to me would be the party that would fight the hardest to keep that information private. Because I don't think at the end of the day the players care, do they?
Well, and most of this information's out anyway. Like, if you want to criticize David Clarkson because he's scoring X number of goals per $1 million he makes, you can do it. You have the information. It's been reported. I think it's probably twofold, and this is me just crazy guessing here, but my guess would be that there is an element of, like Bettman's constituents are the NHL teams, and I'm sure the NHL teams, like you say, don't necessarily want people muddling about in their salary cap business. I think probably the bigger thing, my theory is that the NHL is very forthcoming with statistics that it thinks improve the coverage of the game in areas it wants to see improved. So they talk a lot about storytelling, you know, player involvement. They like it when we talk about the players. They like it when we talk about the game on the ice. But the NHL isn't necessarily as comfortable when we talk about sort of the ugly business underside of it. They aren't as comfortable when we're talking about finances. And I mean, even though we're not getting into the really ugly stuff like public subsidies of arenas, when you start letting in salary or officially providing salary information, you sort of encourage that business side coverage of the game, which I don't think the league really wants to see.
And that's a really interesting point, because, you know, one of the things that they've preached about the adoption of analytics, especially John Collins, the COO of the league, has said this, is that it gives them the chance to tell a bigger story about games and players and teams. And it gives fans another entry point to games and players and teams. It educates them. It gives you another approach. It rounds out the narrative. And as much as they might feel like the business side should be separate from the on-ice side, there's no question that the entry point for a lot of people to professional sports is, can I make this trade? What does my team need? Could we? Yeah. Why did we pay this guy? Like, it seems sort of counterintuitive to the stuff they're preaching about why they're expanding the scope of NHL.com to then not include this kind of information.
I agree completely. I think it's if that is in fact what we're doing, because I mean, we're both going off my crazy guess here, right? But if that is what they're doing, then it's really, I think it's selling fans short, because there's huge interest in. It's not just like fans don't just watch the game. It's not all 12-year-old kids saying, you know, someday I want to play in the NHL. And it's not just 30-year-old guys living vicariously who are, you know, failed professional athletes. There's a huge amount of interest in looking at a team and saying, you know what, I could run this team. This is what I would do. This is something that, well, fantasy sports, I mean, that's basically what it is, right? Is it fills that desire to say, you know what, I could run this team better than my neighbor down the street. And I think that's a big part of the fan experience, is putting yourself in the GM's shoes.
That's a great point. I mean, and fantasy sports has obviously gone in a direction where we now have, you know, dynasty leagues and franchises and people are, you know, managing their own cap too. So you're completely right. It's looked like that. All right. Getting off the stats stuff for a second. I'm particularly interested in your take on the Western Conference. That bubble is a mess right now, with at least five teams that are in the mix for maybe three playoff spots, maybe a couple more. How do you think this thing shakes out? If you're going to be a betting man, who's on the inside, who's on the outside when the season's done as far as the Western Conference bubble?
Well, I think we'll see the four teams in the Central stick it out. I mean, obviously, there's the three Giants in Winnipeg. Winnipeg's faltered a little bit, but they've got a bit of a head start, so they should really make it, even if they slump it a bit. The Pacific Division's a total mess after Anaheim. I sort of suspect we'll see Vancouver hang on to the second spot. L.A., I think, will make it. They're a much better team than their record shows. And, I mean, you can't predict how these things will turn out over 20 games, but they've done well lately, and they should make it. As for the last sort of spot there, that's really tough. I mean, you've got San Jose and Minnesota and Calgary. I sort of lean towards Minnesota now that they've got their goaltending fixed, but it's going to be a dogfight all the way to the end.
Yeah, and Calgary, I think we're all kind of waiting for the bottom to drop out, if indeed it does. At some point, you're dealing with a lot of young players that may or may not hit the wall. And, you know, San Jose, having seen them over the weekend in that Stadium Series game, there's just something off about it. Like, there are times when I think the mix is right, where they've got these veteran guys that are being pushed by younger players, you know, Carlson playing up with Marlow and Thornton, for example, and things like that. But at the same time, there just doesn't seem to be that extra element that's going to necessarily push them to win 5-6 games in a row and really put the rest of the competition away. There's something weird happening there. I don't know what. I can't put my finger on it, though.
Yeah, San Jose is a really weird team this year. And I think, to me, it all sort of goes back to that summer where they concentrated on guys like John Scott and Mike Brown, and they almost intentionally hobbled themselves, is what it seemed like from the outside. And, I mean, if you're ownership and you're looking at Doug Wilson, and I mean, Doug Wilson, you know, his name's been in rumors of getting canned for years now. If you look at him and the job he did, and your team finishes 2 points out of the playoffs, I would be livid if I was the ownership, because that's millions of dollars I'm losing out on, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right on about his head being on the chopping block as well. One last one, and you mentioned Vancouver, and they're kind of fascinating. You know, we're all kind of waiting. I haven't seen if anything official's come down on Ryan Miller yet, but I think Eddie Lack's a very capable goalie. I'm not quite sure if that's necessarily a death blow if Miller's out for a bit. But you seem to like them as a playoff team. I picked them as a playoff team based on the strength of their coach more than anything else. But it's been sort of smoke and mirrors offensively for them a little bit this season. What do you like about Vancouver that has you thinking they could hold on to that second seed in the division?
Well, I mean, part of it's that they have the head start, which is a big help, because, I mean, if it comes down to the nail, like to the very end of the season, and you've got a 3-point lead right now, that's a massive head start. But the other thing, I'm sort of like you, I thought they were a better team last year, and, you know, coaching and a lot of other factors sort of torpedoed them. I think they've actually taken a step back talent-wise this year from the team they were a year ago, but they still have a very solid defense. They've got the Sedin twins who take, you know, no end to abuse but play an incredible two-way game. Like, they spend more time in the opposition end. I think there's enough there to drag the team into the playoffs between the defense and the Sedins, even with Miller out, because I don't think Miller's been a difference maker for them this year.
Yeah, no, neither do I. And finally, sir, did you get a chance to read that Lirianov piece on the Players Tribune?
I did. It was fantastic.
It was fantastic, but, I mean, I don't think anyone could. For those that haven't read it, it's a great piece about, you know, not only his time with the Red Army team and the influence they had on the NHL, but there's a great section in there about how offensive creativity is stifled and suffocated in the league, not necessarily because of the physicality and the North American style, but because of the way the coaches preach conservative style, defense first, fit the system, don't try to do anything outside the system, that sort of thing. You're an Edmonton guy. I imagine you probably had your thoughts go immediately to Nail Yakupov as you're reading that piece. And my question to you is, because I have a piece on Puck Daddy that we'll publish as soon as we get our publishing platform deboned today. But, you know, like, I'm reading this thing and I'm thinking to myself, you could make the argument that there is a stifling of offensive creativity in this league, but you can also make the argument that sometimes offensively creative players are defensive liabilities. And what Lirianov has made the case about Yakupov in the past is that's okay. Like, Lirianov was the guy who would cover both ends of the ice, allowing other players that were maybe not as good defensively to do their thing. And so it's okay that Yakupov isn't a well-rounded player. Do you kind of agree with that or no?
Well, I wouldn't agree with... Oh, yeah. Yakupov's a bit of a difficult case, just because he is so bad defensively. He probably shouldn't have been in the NHL as early as he was. I mean, there's always that expectation with the number one overall pick, but to me, he's a guy who could have used more seasoning. Reading Lirianov's piece, I went back to a conversation I had last year with Todd Nelson, you know, now the interim coach in Edmonton, was in Oklahoma City. And he was telling me about how European players adapt to the game. And he was saying, you know, a lot of these guys, you got to teach them to move forward, like a more of a stop-start system, whereas they're taught, you know, go east-west, maintain possession. And his explanation of it to me, and Nelson's a guy who's a very offense-minded coach, was was the Detroit system, which Larionov came up in, was that, you know, you want short passes up the ice, you want constant forward momentum. And to me, Detroit's a team that has been offensively capable all through the years. I mean, Larionov praises them for their willingness to let Datsyuk make mistakes. To me, some of it is on the bigger ice in Europe, you can play more of an east-west style than you simply can in North America. And I don't buy the idea that North American coaches are squeezing the life out of the game, because we saw how teams played in the Sochi Olympics. Like, Russian teams are not high-scoring teams. If you watched any KHL during the lockout, it's a very passive game. There is a lot of puck possession, but that's partially because there's so much space, it's hard to get the puck back, and it's hard to make stuff happen around the net. So I really enjoyed Larionov's piece. I thought it was excellent. I thought it raised some good points and some good questions, but I don't think that his philosophy really stands up entirely if you look at the facts.
Yeah, and I thought also was a situation where it kind of overlooks the notion of the well-rounded player. I mean, he had the good fortune of being one.
Yeah.
Other guys aren't necessarily the same way. And the idea that you're going to drop a guy down to the third or fourth line if he can't play a well-rounded game in this league, like, you can't be Yakupov in this league. I mean, for all the God-given offensive talent that he has, you can't have a player who's a defensive liability on your top line. You're going to beat Chicago with that, with having two guys that can play a 200-foot game and one guy who can't? Of course you're not.
Well, and that's the thing, right, is you raise an interesting point about knocking a guy down to the third line. Maybe that to me is maybe a supporting argument for Larionov's column, because why does the third and fourth line have to be a super defensive, responsible unit? Like, you know, we're sort of trained, the first two lines are scoring lines, your third line is a checking line, your fourth line is an energy line. And I think increasingly we're seeing that model's extremely limited. You can do more things with your third and fourth line. You can have a third line that's, you know, maybe some strong offensive players with who are a little weaker defensively, and you use them more carefully as a coach. But I do think, I mean, it's all about what you score versus what gets scored against, right? If you're not on the positive side of that ledger, you're not making an impact no matter how much you score.
And I think the real interesting evolution insofar as like checking lines and things like that, to be honest with you, is the fact that we see so many teams now that go strength for strength. I mean, the Taves line, he gets criticized in the playoffs for not scoring. That's because he's the checking line. The, you know, Bergeron's line.
Yep.
There are so many great two-way centers now in the game that their teams go strength for strength, top line versus top line, with the hopes of not necessarily having one outscore the other, but using one to neutralize the other. And that had, to me, has completely rewritten the rules of where these what these lines were supposed to do based on their ice time.
Absolutely. You look at, I'm going to stick with Chicago because it's a great example. The Taves line has always been a power versus power line. Like most top lines along the league, if you're playing on the first unit, you have to be able to take on the opposition's best. But what Chicago has done is they don't have, you know, their second and third lines are both scoring lines. Now, their fourth line's a checking line, but it's a checking line in the sense that it takes on a ton of defensive zone draws. Like, those guys start in their own end of the rink 9 times out of 10. And that is a really interesting evolution of the game, you know. That way you have a guy like Taves, he still has some offensive opportunity, but he has to really fight for it against top players. And you have your checking line guys, your guys who can't really score a lot. Well, you're deploying them on the defensive zone, the defensive side of the ice, to try and, you know, negate those face-offs. And that frees up your second and third lines to score.
Exactly. And you'll be able to find out all about quality of competition on the new NHL.com for a small fee at some point, I'm sure. Jonathan Willups, tell everybody out there where we can find all your genius, sir.
Probably the best place is just at Jonathan Willups on Twitter.
There you go, a clearinghouse of all the things that you do. All right, thank you so much for joining us, man. I always love talking puck with you, and we'll talk to you down the line.
My pleasure. Take care, Greg.
Jay Will joining us. Listen, I ain't going to lie to you. Some of the stats stuff is heady for me. I'm not a math major, and Jonathan is a guy who sometimes I read his stuff, and I struggle. I struggle to get through the density of the information. But he's smart as shit. And his work on Cult of Hockey, insofar as the analytics, I mean, part of that sort of analytics mafia that they've had in Edmonton for many years, it's great stuff. And it's eye-opening stuff, and it's game-changing stuff, and I highly recommend that you search it out and read it. It's very good stuff. One of the names on the I want to get to another thought on Lirianov in a second, but I want to forget about this one. One of the names on the goalie cup of coffee list, for example, Steve Penny. Remember Steve Penny? Now, this is a tougher one because he did play 54 games for Montreal, then 18 more the next season from 84 to 86. Played in the playoffs in 84, played in the playoffs in 85, played 27 games. It's a little bit more than a cup of coffee. It's a venti, I think, probably would be the thing to say about him. But definitely not somebody who stuck around. Ditto Jim Carrey, who, again, is more than a venti. I think he's probably a box of Joe from Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, if you win a Vezina, you're probably a box of Joe versus a cup of coffee. But that's another name that's come up a few times. Steve Penny, by the way, third for the Vezina. I'm third for the Calder, seventh for the Vezina in 85 for Montreal. Out of the league by 88 last season with Winnipeg. It's kind of crazy. I wanted to mention one thing about that Lirianov piece that I found interesting, which is he talks about the coaches in every level stifling creativity for players. And it got me thinking about the fact that a player like Igor Lirianov, for example, doesn't necessarily become a coach all the time. We've seen some really good players become coaches. We've seen Adam Oates. We've seen Kirk Muller. We have seen a player like, for example, Wayne Gretzky. We've seen these guys become head coaches, and some of them stumble. And we've talked about the Gretzky example many times in this show. You know, we've talked about the fact that Gretzky kind of became head coach, and in the case of young players like Kyle Turris, it was less about instruction and more about frustration. Why can't you do the things I do? Why can't you see the ice the way I see it? And I find it interesting that so many elite offensive players seem to gravitate towards player personnel and management than they do X's and O's. Now, that might just be the current trend where we see an entire generation of guys like Sakic and Nieuwendyk and LaFontaine for a brief time and Yzerman and all these guys. Messier wants to get into it. All these guys have gotten into player personnel and management while you see your Gerard Gallants, your Dan Bylsmas, players like that gravitate towards coaching. Now, I have a theory about this, and it goes a little something like this. You have to pay your dues to be a coach. You got to be an assistant for a while. Maybe you go to the AHL. There are some exceptions to the rule, but you got to pay your dues. And then as a head coach, it's kind of a thankless job sometimes. You don't have total security, a little bit more stress, got to manage egos a bit. Got to be at the rink a certain time every day. It's a lot more pluggish work than there is when you get the big office. So I'm thinking to myself, all right, if you were a star player, a Hall of Fame player, a player with some modicum of ego, what would you rather do? Would you rather have the job where there's plenty of security, you don't have to strap on the skates, and try to convince a bunch of spoiled millionaires to listen to you and play your system? Or would you rather be able to pick and choose the spoiled millionaires that get to be on your team? So, in essence, the question for Lirianov is, why aren't there more offensive coaches? Why aren't there more offensive systems? I think, frankly, it's because a lot of really brilliant offensive players don't become coaches. Is there any way to, you know, empirically prove that? Not necessarily. But observationally and anecdotally, that's kind of what you see, isn't it? Anyways, I think I just published the piece on Puck Daddy, so give it a read if you get a chance. But I wanted to close out with two things today on this Sans Merrick edition of the podcast. First is, I was in Santa Clara for the Stadium Series game between the Sharks and the Kings. Wasn't the weird-ass fun that Dodger Stadium was, but still was a blast. Things I learned. I did not know that tailgating was banned at the SAP Center. I learned that because the Sharks fans that were tailgating at Levi Stadium were having a blast. It was like being let out of their cages. And the atmosphere around that place before the game was awesome. Very awesome. The other thing I learned about Levi's Stadium is that evidently the company that I work for has an entire level of the stadium that's theirs. The Yahoo Fantasy Lounge. I shot some video there with Kevin Weeks and Marty Biron that's going to be on Puck Daddy coming up soon, but it's like purple walls and exclamation points and a running ticker of fantasy stats, and I was like, wow. Like, I didn't know this existed. And I thought to myself, if I lived here, could I get in with my employee ID? And evidently you can't. So there's no ancillary benefit to me, but it was just cool to be immersed in like your company's pimp suite at the state-of-the-art football stadium where the Niners play. It was pretty cool. The third thing is this. Third thing, by the way, John Fogerty still rocks, and maybe Melissa Etheridge wasn't the greatest choice for a stadium. Just saying. I love her stuff, but maybe not the best choice for a stadium. The third thing is this. When you have two teams that are in a four-point game that are battling on the bubble for their playoff lives, and the Kings come into the game with three games in hand, and the Sharks are trying to turn their season around, and there's a lot on the line, the outdoor game experience kind of changes a little bit. Now, it didn't change that much for the Sharks. They came out, they soaked it in, they had a blast. You could tell that guys like Logan Couture, for example, were thrilled to be inside the Niners locker room. It was a real, real cool thing. It was that starry-eyed thing that you see teams have all the time when they've done this for the first time. The Kings have not done this for the first time. They did it last year. This is now old hat for them, apparently. Because I have not seen a team in these outdoor games be as completely businesslike and almost joyless as the Kings. They came into the game. They were on a winning streak. They continued it. They got in for a late practice on Friday. They did their thing. And then the rest of us, the media was kind of waiting around because the way this thing usually works is you have your skate, then your families come out, and you have a little skate with the little kids and girlfriends and wives and stuff, and then you talk to us. Except there was no family skate. The Kings told their families to stay home. They already did it last year. They got all the pictures they need from Dodger Stadium. The novelty had worn off. It was business for them. And the end result is they skate out of there with 2 points. And the Sharks get nothing. And I wonder whether or not when you start to see some teams like Chicago, for example, do this thing on the regular, if you're going to see some of that whimsical boys in the pond kind of vibe drained from these games, especially when the games mean so much in the standings. This is the first time I saw a team not play ball with the, you know, enjoy the moment, joyous occasion, a chance to be with your family's aspect of the game, of the outdoor game. And the end result is that they won. And the end result is Todd McClellan after the game said, you know, I caught my guys kind of looking around a few times at the 70,000 fans that were there to watch the game. So that was really interesting. I'll say this about the Sharks. You could tell that the desire is there. You could tell that the effort was there. They played a really good game against the Kings, especially in that second period. They outplayed them in the second. I thought they were going to come away with something more than they got. You could tell it's there. It's for whatever reason, they can't find the mix. They can't find the consistency. And it's got to be frustrating. Will they get in? There's still a part of me that thinks they're good enough to get in. And that it may still be Minnesota on the outside looking in. And that could just be Dubnyk coming back down to earth at some point. Although the team is playing outstanding in front of them. But they're just, like Willis said, man, there's something about the Sharks that just seems a little bit off. And, again, best effort, couldn't get that goal, couldn't be quick. Kings get out of there with a win. Really well played game. Really fun game to watch. And the stadium series rolls on. 70,000 fans. 110,000 fans have watched outdoor hockey in California in the last 2 years. not too shabby. All right. In the remaining few moments of the show, I will talk to you about the Oscars. Goodbye, Karen Douglas, and those who don't like to listen to me talk about pop culture. But this is what happens when Jeffy isn't here. I went 15 for 24, I think it was, 23, on the Oscar ballot last night. I made a few mistakes. I thought Michael Keaton would squeak out a win. He did not. I thought they might do the Boyhood Birdman split for director and best picture, just to give Linklater a pat on the head for all the effort. They did not. I didn't realize that Ida would win for best foreign picture. I thought that would be Leviathan. So some mistakes were made. But overall, I thought the show was extraordinarily long. Extraordinarily long. Like, longer than I can remember it ever being. Like, 45 minutes longer than it should have been. And I thought some of the speeches, obviously, the Arquette speech was heartfelt. The Moore guy's speech was heartfelt. The J.K. Simmons speech was heartfelt. There's a lot of really good stuff. And I think that the award recipients have finally figured out how to beat the orchestra, which is that you keep the most emotionally devastating things that you have in your hip pocket until the very end of the speech. And then they will shut the music off. Like, there was a guy, I forget who it was, that was getting played off. And then at one point he kind of says over the music, "I also want to mention my late wife." And you just heard, like, tire screeching and the record scratching. And the music stopped. So they've got this thing figured out, which is why the whole show went, 45 minutes over. Neil Patrick Harris tried his best, had some funny lines. Benedict Cumberbatch being a John Travolta mispronunciation was very funny. Locking away Oscar predictions in a briefcase, not so funny. Not a very good bit. Kind of the Uma Oprah of these Oscars, I felt. But overall, a good year for film. You could make the case for a lot of different things. I didn't think any egregious snubs outside of maybe Best Actor for Selma, you could argue. And then obviously the Lego Movie for animated. But a good year. And the bottom line about Birdman is this. If you make a movie that speaks to the people voting for the movies, it's probably going to win. Also, if you perform as an actor in a way that's going to make the other actors really appreciate your effort, i.e. Eddie Redmayne for The Theory of Everything, you're probably going to win. That's a tried and true aspect of this thing. Why do you think Chicago won? Anyways, that's the Oscars. I'm a fan. Fashion was great too, as well. To be honest, ScarJo, grade A. Margot Robbie, I don't know, not my cup of tea. Anyways, that's the show for today. Everybody, thanks for chiming in with your cup of coffee goalies. Thanks to a cup of coffee goalie named Rob Zepp. The one interesting thing about Zepp, I'll say it, I didn't ask him about this because we were pressed for time. What's the end game? Is he content being a tweener? Is he playing for another job in this league? Does he kind of feel like maybe he's reached the pinnacle? I don't know. But I do know that he has given that team some great efforts this season and really gave them an effort they needed over the weekend. So good on him. And thanks to Jonathan Willis for chiming in about the NHL.com stats revolution and Western Conference hockey and that Larry Onoff piece, which you should go read on the Players Tribune. That's two big, great stories they've had on that Jeter site, the Lurianoff piece and the Brandon Press piece. So good job out of them. And we'll join you back here on the morrow. Thanks to Maddie Brown. See you tomorrow. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.